is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome all of you to our hearing this morning. So we're especially delighted to welcome students that we have with us today. We have students from Durand High School. Would they stand, please? Seeing you, thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Wapaka High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. We're delighted to see you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. It is a national award-winning program entitled, cleverly, Court with Class. And the program invites students from all around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if they join us, they've sent copies of the brief of the case that they're going to hear, and they have miscellaneous activities relating to that case, depending on the school. In addition to that, the students will meet with a justice of the court after this argument. The justice will talk with the students about the procedures the court uses in taking and deciding cases. The substantive issues of the case will not be discussed. All of you are welcome, students and non-students, to join in that discussion after this case. We also have available a synopsis of the case you're about to hear, so if there's anyone in the court who needs additional material for the case, if you raise your hand, the marshal will distribute the synopsis to you. Ms. Snowdell? We have settled that justices do not get a copy of this summary. With that statement made, I'll now I should first introduce the members of the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right is Justice Patrick Crooks. The students and others will meet with Justice Crooks after this argument. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Introductions made, I'll now call our second case today, 2005 AP 323, Wisconsin Mall Properties, LLC versus Yonkers, Inc., City of Green Bay, City of Green Bay Redevelopment. Representing Wisconsin Mall Properties is Catherine Stadler, Attorney Stadler. You may proceed. Let me, just before your light goes on, make sure that we have the right lineup. Mr. Markovitz will argue for 15 minutes representing Yonkers. Mr. Southwick will argue 15 minutes representing the City of Green Bay and the Redevelopment Authority. And Mr. Conway has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that correct? Okay. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. As you stated, my name is Catherine Stadler. With me is Greg Conway, and we appear on behalf of Wisconsin Mall Properties, LLC. May it please the court. Condemnation cannot trump private contractual rights, especially when the parties expressly anticipated condemnation and agreed that their obligations to one another would continue even if the property were condemned. We have just heard compelling arguments in the Sunday case, involving another piece of real estate that was condemned and another contract that affected the real estate. We have the fortunate circumstance in our case of not needing to worry our collective pretty heads about the meaning of the word transaction or the meaning of any word, because the contract in this case was explicit and clear and negotiated by commercially sophisticated parties with competent representation and almost without dispute specifically anticipated the occurrence that happened here. Notwithstanding all of that, the Sachs Corporation comes here today to ask this court to let it out of its contractual obligation.
Counsel, what is the breach of the contract on which you're suing?
Wisconsin Mall Property sued the Sachs Company for a breach of the lease and its good faith provision, which appears in Section 5.1C of the lease. That provision requires that Sachs will not take action to try to avoid its obligations under the lease. Fairly simple provision, and one that Wisconsin Mall contends was breached when Sachs colluded with the city of Green Bay to have the property taken by condemnation in order for the sole purpose of avoiding its contractual rights to Wisconsin Mall.
And what's the damage for that breach? Assuming we accept your concept of the breach, what's the damage?
The damages are defined in Section 7.1 of the lease, particularly 7.1G, which states that upon an event of default, the lessor, in this case Wisconsin Mall Properties, has the right to demand the entire value of the then due lease payments discounted to present value at the moment of the breach.
Okay. Now, my next question is, if that's true, how much would the – and that figure has not been determined. This is summary judgment. Okay.
Right.
That's the figure. Let's just say it's $4 million. Just suppose. Is the discounted value of that stream of income, the present discounted value of that stream of income, has that been paid for in the is that an issue in the condemnation proceeding as to what the value is, and are you getting that from the city?
The answer is no.
Okay, tell me why not.
The condemnation award that the city of Green Bay paid included an element that was itemized as the current value of the leasehold interest, that future income stream that we're talking about. The valuation that the city gave that future income stream was $3.1 million. The 5% calculation that's called for under 7.1G of the lease would result in a larger number. That's the number that needs to be tried.
Go ahead.
Aren't you going to say that in your proceeding in condemnation and ask for more than $3.1 million?
Yes. However, the condemnation court is limited by the condemnation statute in the award that it can give them all. And while we will certainly argue to the condemnation court, if this court agrees that that's our only recourse, that we ought to be entitled to our contractual damages. And in fact, the Court of Appeals suggested that we are entitled to our contractual damages in condemnation court. We are not at all confident that the current state of the law allows the condemnation court to award contractual damages above and beyond the value of the property.
Counsel, just so, and I want to be clear on this, I thought totally you got 5.7, which
correct.
Included the 3.1, and then for your revisionary interest, you got another 2.6.
Correct.
So when you say 3.1, so you did get you did get another 2.6 million.
Correct. Yes, that's correct. When I referred to 3.1, I was answering the question about the reversionary. I'm sorry, not the reversionary.
Oh, not
just
the
income
right.
stream. Correct. Right. Which was, in our view, undervalued by the city, not surprisingly, because the actual rental value of the property was not what the contract said.
And that 2.6 was based on what? What was that?
The 2.6 in the city's jurisdictional offer was based on the city's own appraisal.
Yes, but it was for what?
The building, the reversionary interest, the bricks, the mortar, the land underneath.
Which you would, which you're claiming you would have received, I think, $600,000, whatever it was per year for that, that, okay.
Correct. Correct. On top of the value of the land itself.
Counselor, if you prevail here and you go back down, won't you have to subtract from any damages you can prove at trial everything you were paid for the value of the lease here in the condemnation action?
That was the Court of Appeals order, and that certainly would appear to be the law of damages. However,
you dispute that?
No.
Okay. That's all I need to know.
No, the issue of damages is for the trial court to determine as a matter of law. I'm sorry, as a matter of fact, the Court of Appeals has instructed whether we end up here and then go back to the trial court or whether we went straight back to the trial court, that the condemnation court that hears this case would take into account an offset for the amounts already received.
What do you want this court to do?
We want a remand, Your Honor.
I mean, that's right, because otherwise you're totally out of court.
Okay. That's right. Well, not true exactly. We're out of this court. We're not out of condemnation court. We want to remand to the circuit court, not under Chapter 32, but under the common law and the contractual enforcement rights that we have.
Why shouldn't you be under 32?
Because our dispute is not with the City of Green Bay. Our dispute is with the Sachs Company. And the condemnation proceeding addresses a difference between the landowner and the condemning authority over what the condemning authority did. My client chose not to dispute what the City of Green Bay did. It has a quarrel with the calculated business decision that the Sachs Company made to avoid its obligation under the lease that has nothing to do with the City of Green Bay's conduct. Sachs doesn't even have to be a party to an appeal in condemnation court. They're done. They paid the money to the city. The money went to my client to offset the just compensation award. And the appeal to condemnation court is going to be between my client and the City of Green Bay. And the bad guy is gone.
Well, here's the problem in a very simple and I hope not simplistic way. It sounds like you are asking as damages the fair market value of your stream of income from the lease.
We are not.
What are you asking for? Or the present value of
the stream. We're asking for the present value of the contractual damages, correct.
But what I don't hear, it's maybe my fault, but
I doubt it.
Well, don't say that so quickly. I don't hear how that is different than what you are owed under fair market value
in a condemnation.
That seems to me to be the kicker.
Right.
If they are the same, then you're in the wrong jurisdiction. If they are, it would so appear because that's exclusive. Condemnation is exclusive remedy. If they are different, then at least I have to know what the difference is, and then I can say, well, right, condemnation doesn't destroy all contracts. We saw that in Sunday. Nobody argued that the whole broker contract was destroyed. The question was how do you interpret it and does it apply? So tell me the difference in what dollar calculation you're going to get in the two transactions.
First of all, your assumption that they're going to be the same may be correct and it may not. We don't know that for sure because of the absence of case law instructing the condemnation court on this point. As we heard in the earlier case, the fair market value concept, which is what underlies just compensation and condemnation, requires an assessor, an appraiser, or somebody valuing the property to come up with a hypothetical willing buyer and a hypothetical willing seller, neither of whom is under duress. Everybody agrees that no such sellers or buyers exist in this situation. The city's appraiser acknowledged that the department store was beyond its useful life as a department store. Without this lease, No other department store company is going to come in and use it as a property. Its value is solely to the holder of the lease, Wisconsin Mall Properties, because of the lease obligation that's on it. So the condemnation court is going to have a heck of a time coming up with a number that equals our contract damages when nobody will stand in front of the condemnation court and say, this is really worth that much.
But you've got, the city has a valid lease with Yonkers Saks. The city, which is now owning the property, has that stream of income. Now, maybe because of circumstances, Saks Yonkers is overpaying on the lease, but that lease is still good. So that city has the same stream of income that you would have been entitled to. So they ought to buy it for you at what is a present value.
It's an interesting point. The city would have had the entitlement to the stream of income from the lease had they not, after condemnation, let Saks out of its obligation.
No, but I don't know how that would affect the valuation of the lease at the moment of condemnation.
Right. Well, the point is really this, and the answer to your question lies in the remedies available to the various tribunals. The condemnation court is restricted by the four corners of Chapter 32 and what it can do. Assuming all that other stuff came out the same, and the future income stream and the city appraiser and everybody agreed that it was all going to come out to the same number, we are still coming up short. The condemnation statute only permits the contesting party, in this case Wisconsin Mall Properties, to recover its attorney's fees and costs of the action if it exceeds the jurisdictional offer by 15%.
Right.
So there's one hurdle there that doesn't exist in circuit court.
Right.
The second hurdle is that the condemnation...
Sounds like the broker case.
What?
As to attorney fees, it sort of sounds like the broker case. We have to look at your contract, and your contract has...
Our fees,
the attorney fees in 6.2.
Correct. The attorney fees associated with the condemnation in 6.2, Section 7.1G, I believe, has a pretty common feature of commercial leases and non-commercial leases, too, that says if the landlord has to sue you to enforce it, they get their attorney's fees and costs.
Okay. But before we get to attorney fees, I still want to know whether theoretically, the value that the city should be paying you for the lease is the same as you were entitled to under the contract.
Theoretically, it should, and that's the argument that we will make to the condemnation court, but because of the ambiguity in the law that the condemnation court is going to apply, and because the jury in the condemnation court is going to be instructed to make inferences in favor of the city, and because the jury in the case is going to be taxpayers of the city of Green Bay who know that they're going to be writing the check for the damages award, we are not entirely confident that that would happen.
Okay.
In other words, we're coming up short in condemnation court when the issue to be litigated is not a condemnation issue. The issue is the breach of contract by the Saks company and the breach of the hell or high water provision of the lease that provided unambiguously that Saks' obligation to pay rent would continue, notwithstanding a condemnation. And despite that very clear language, and despite the contemplation of the parties that their obligations would continue on condemnation, Saks orchestrated this entire series of events that resulted in it not having to be in the city of downtown Green Bay, not having to pay rent to Saks, I mean, not having to pay rent to the mall, not having to pay rent to the city, and not having to pay any other taxes or obligations on the property. The purpose of the lease between the two parties was to ensure Wisconsin Mall Properties the stream of income from the lease. It was designed as a financing transaction to ensure that the mall would recoup the money that it put up in front so that Saks could take cash out of the property and recoup that income over a period of time, just as a bank would collect mortgage payments. And it is that obligation that Saks used this condemnation process to get out of, knowing full well that it would be able to take advantage of the law that we're discussing here today.
What exactly? So that's your, I know your argument is that they colluded. Their argument is, of course, what we did was open, it was transparent, it was good faith. So if we were to, basically, if we don't buy your argument, then, of course, this would say that you're back in 32 and not, is that correct or not?
No, not necessarily.
Right.
Our assertion is that the breach of the contract is so clear based on the record evidence that is in the record, notwithstanding the fact that this is a summary judgment case, that the court could, this court could find as a matter of law that a breach occurred. If it doesn't, then whether a breach occurred is a fact issue for the trial court, a fact issue that we never got to present evidence on because the trial court said it doesn't matter if they breached the contract. It doesn't matter what your damages would be because a condemnation law trumps. And that's the decision that has the error, and that's why we want the remand to trial court, circuit court, not condemnation court.
Ms. Stadler, let me tell you what bothers me, and maybe you can tell me where I'm wrong. My understanding of the arguments of opposing counsel would be along the lines that you had this lease agreement with Yonkers, Saks, whatever, and you no longer have the lease rights because through condemnation, those lease rights have been transferred to the city of Green Bay. If that's indeed true, what gives you the basis to now attempt to enforce a provision in that lease?
What gives us the right is the accrual of our cause of action for breach of contract against Saks prior to the condemnation.
Do you have any case law that supports that position?
The case law defining contractual obligations, breach of contract, and the purpose of contract law would be our authority. The purpose of contract cases are to effectuate the intent of the parties, to give the parties the benefit of the bargain. And the parties here specifically bargained for, notwithstanding a condemnation, the payments to continue. That didn't happen because the Saks company made it not happen. And that cause of action for breach occurred at the moment that Saks went to the city and said, let's work a deal. And that damages claim accrued at the time of the breach, and that is the entitlement to damages that we're seeking to pursue in circuit court. The fact that a week or a month or a year later the property was condemned and the going forward rights to collect rent under the lease may have accrued to the city, although they never collected any rent, doesn't matter because the accrual of the contract cause of action happened prior to the condemnation.
Did Yonkers continue to make payments to you folks until such time as the condemnation procedure was accomplished and title was transferred?
They did, as was their obligation under the contract. Notwithstanding any dispute about a breach, their obligation to pay rent would continue.
That's why you have to rely on the breach being the collusion concept, because all the payments for rent were made by Yonkers.
Well, up until the date of the condemnation. Now, if you adopt the Saks and City's argument that nothing happened to this lease, it's still running, City's just the landlord now. Mm-hmm. If you adopt that theory, then the lease didn't die and it's still going, in which case Saks has breached it because they haven't been paying us.
Yeah, but that's not your problem. If the city wants to let them breach, that's the city's problem.
Right. Well, in fact, what happened is they renegotiated and got a new lease.
And a new deal.
Sorry, what?
They had a new deal,
yes.
And that again, does not affect you. That's why you have to rely on the breach being the collusion.
Correct.
And the problem is that your damages sound like the same damages that you should be seeking in condemnation.
They may sound like the same damages, but they're not the same damages, because what we're seeking is damages against the Saks company. What the condemnation court can give us is damages from the city of Green Bay. That makes a world of difference. On top of that, you have the problem that the city and the condemnation court is going to face in valuing the property under the current law, and you're going to have the additional problem of the costs and attorney's fees, which, given the circuit court action and the parallel condemnation, the various levels of appeals are not insignificant in this case.
But well, the Court of Appeals says you're out of court, if I read that right.
Right. Well,
and they say
Chapter 32, correct.
That's right.
Right.
You're out of court on this proceeding.
Right.
You do a 32, you can appeal, you're in 32. And then if you're entitled under the contract to attorney fees, well, the city owes you that under the contract now because they took it all over, all of the rights but all of the responsibilities. I mean,
right.
That's how I read it.
Yes, and that is what the Court of Appeals said. Interestingly, the city, in its responsive brief, says, we're not so sure about that. We're not sure we like that. We don't want the Court of Appeals telling our condemnation court that we've got to pay contract damages to Wisconsin Mall Properties. We want you, this court, to reconsider that opinion of the Court of Appeals. So even though the Court of Appeals appears to have instructed the condemnation court in that regard, the parties certainly aren't in agreement that that's a remedy that we have. And the law is certainly not clear on that, given what the statute says, the condemnation statute says.
Could you re-articulate for me precisely what it is that takes something out of Chapter 32 and makes it a separate contract case?
I can. I think the statement of the issue as what takes something out of Chapter 32 misdirects the answer. We were never in Chapter 32. This would be taking a private contract right of action and putting it into Chapter 32 in the first place, not taking a Chapter 32 action and taking it out. We never sought to be in condemnation court. We never sought to contest the condemnation right of the city. We were forced to make that sole remedy choice by the Court of Appeals decision and the running of the statute of limitations. Our preference is to pursue the contractual cause of action against the private party that breached the hell or high water provision.
Counsel, you challenged, I thought, the whole right of the city to take the property. But then you dropped that.
Correct.
And then you challenged the amount given in the award. And you're still, at least at the time of the briefs, you're still fighting about dollars. Is that right?
Yes and no. We initially brought a challenge under Chapter 32.05 to challenge the propriety of the taking. That is the proceeding that we did not pursue. The Chapter 32.05 sub 11 appeal is still pending, but is stayed pending the outcome of this proceeding.
That's the dollar amount that you're entitled to.
That's the just compensation appeal, correct.
Well, then could I rephrase my question? When do you have a right to proceed in contract and not have your case governed by Chapter 32?
When your contract contemplates condemnation. When your contract says, even if this thing is condemned, we're still going to honor it, that's about as clear as it gets. If this contract had not addressed condemnation, we would have a totally different case. But if you step back to the Sunday case for a second, all of the problems in that case could have been avoided if the village of Pleasant Prairie had come up with the scheme that Sachs did here and said, oh, just condemn the listing contract. The right to pay the commission would evaporate. This case specifically contemplated that the condemnation might happen and that the obligation to make the payments, the loan payments under the lease, would continue notwithstanding that. That makes it entirely different from another contract right of action that may or may not be affected by a condemnation.
Is a listing contract an interest in property like a lease is?
It can be. I shouldn't say that the contract itself can be. If the landlord doesn't pay the commission for whatever reason, the listing agent can put a lien on the property, and the lien would run with the land.
That's another step down the road. Yes. I guess I was just picking up on your comment that they could have condemned the listing contract, and I'm kind of trying to figure out. I understand how you condemn
the leasehold, because under our unit rule, you've got to condemn every interest in property. But I hadn't thought a listing contract was such an interest.
I think you're right. It certainly isn't in the traditional sense. But the point is the same. Nobody condemned a leasehold this way before either. So why couldn't somebody come up with a theory that they could condemn the listing contract?
No, even if they hadn't condemned it, I thought that was very interesting because nobody contested that. I found that was one of the more interesting questions that perked up my interest. But even if they hadn't condemned it under the unit rule, they've got to pay just compensation for every interest in property. So you maybe would just end up in the same place anyway. It's not an issue in this case, but I thought it was interesting.
Right. Well, the interesting thing, of course, about the unit rule is, as it's defined in Van Asten, mm-hmm. this case flips it entirely on its head because mm-hmm. it involves how the lessor and the lessee divide up the condemnation award. In this case, there was a negative value in the lease, and also in this case, Sachs had contracted that they would not be entitled to any piece of the condemnation award. So there was no fight over who got the money. It was their money to begin with.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Markowitz, representing Yonkers and Sachs.
May it please the court. I find this to be one of the more difficult arguments, not because of the substance of this case, but never before I've been asked to make the points I want to make in 15 minutes. So what I'd like to offer to the court as part of my remarks is what I will call a ruler. We've heard a lot of conversation about being short. I'd like to offer the court what the ruler is by which to measure. Is someone short here? Is Wisconsin Mall Properties short of anything? And if you'll permit me, I just want to deal with a little bit of history from the record. Here's what the record tells us. In 1994, the mall made a purchase of a package of rights. They paid exactly $6,376,700. That's all in the record. They called it real estate value. They paid transfer fees based on that value in the real estate transfer return. What did they get for the $6,300,000 plus? They got two things. They got the right in the year 2014 to do whatever it then wished, to do with the parcel of real estate. Sell it, redevelop it, lease it. We call that the reversion. They also purchased a stream of payments. And I don't care whether we call them rent or we call them financing payments. You can call them whatever you want. They bought a stream of payments, which was to extend over the next 232 months to the end of the contract. And if you add all of the numbers together, that was about $14.5 million worth of money to come in the future. This measure, this ruler, is what we call the bargain, or some people call the benefit of the bargain. Everything that was in that contract was designed and intended to protect the mall to get the benefit of the bargain. Part of that bargain was received between 1994 and late 2003 when this condemnation took place. During that period of time, according to the record, 111 months of payments were made, totaling approximately $6,900,000. When the condemnation took place, the only part of the bargain not yet received was the reversion and about $7.6 million of payments extending out to the year 2014. When the city and its authority came forward and paid their award, the city measured and paid $2.6 million for the reversion. The city measured and paid $3.1 million for the value of the stream. Now, if what we're...
5% basis, the same as the contract would say?
I think that the city used a higher discount rate to arrive at the present value, and I haven't done the math, but I'm sure council is correct that there would be a difference if it was done at 5% than at the rate it was done.
Well, if you use a higher discount rate, you get a smaller number because you're right. Dividing by a percentage, right. Right?
So if what we're looking at the moment is that the mall received the benefit of its bargain, there are only two alternative conclusions that we can proceed from. One is either the $5.7 million in payments that were made is everything that they're entitled to properly measured, in which case the mall would receive nothing further from anyone. They would have received their entire bargain or benefit of the bargain. You can draw the opposite conclusion, and I will do so for purposes of discussion, if that $5.7 million is short in either or both respects. Our position is the mall should recover that shortage, whatever it turns out to be, once.
From the city.
What? It makes no difference. The city sets whoever once. The mall has consistently claimed that the $5.7 million it did get left it short of its bargain. But it has never denied the position, even to this day, that it is intending to recover all that it is entitled to in condemnation, plus something else, something more. Even though, throughout this record, whenever pressed, they admit the measurement is identical. It's still the reversion, it's still the stream. So the mall stands here before you, demonstrating how they want it both ways. They want more than the benefit of their bargain. They want a windfall. Now, we've cited cases in our brief which indicate that even in a breach of contract situation, which we do not concede exists in this case at all that the offended party is entitled to under Wisconsin law is to receive the benefit of the bargain. They're not supposed to receive the benefit of the bargain plus 10% or the benefit of the bargain plus 50% or the benefit of the bargain plus 100%.
Mr. Markovitz, they concede that, well, at least as I heard it, which may not be what they said, but as I heard it, it's possible that the damages for the breach of the contract will be the same as the evaluation given to them in Chapter 32 proceeding. But they're concerned it might not be. That's how I understand it. It's not that they are asking for more in a windfall. They are asking for what they're entitled to under the contract, and they don't think they'll get it in condemnation because there may be a different measure of value there, and therefore they want the difference. They don't expect ultimately to collect 3 points, something or other, in both places.
It's in the last part of your formulation that we part company.
Okay.
Their concern is there. I'm sure they feel that concern. The question is it well placed? Is it justified?
Okay.
Now, the city has made it very clear that when they took that leasehold, in addition to taking the property, they obligated themselves to do whatever they are required to do under that contract. For example, there's a provision in the contract which says that they recover attorney's fees. That is not the same as what is in the condemnation law, where in order to recover attorney's fees, you must demonstrate that you've broken the glass ceiling of 15%. The city has not said, we'll use condemnation law to determine your entitlement to attorney's fees. The city's brief says, if you've expended some attorney's fees, we're going to have to pay it. That's part of it. So to draw this down, there isn't any justification for the concern, because if they get the full value of the reversion. They get the full value of the income stream. And they're covered on their attorney's fees under the contract. That's everything that they could have hoped for. That's everything that they were entitled to. Only one other piece of my argument before I turn it over to my esteemed colleague, Mr. Southwick. We had a little, very brief colloquy about the significance of the challenge action that was brought by them all. Almost like it was, just a check mark on a checklist. This state makes it very, very difficult, very important for someone who wants to challenge the taking because it's not for a public purpose. It's collusive, it's illegal, it's improper, it's whatever. You have to start a challenge action. And I give them all credit. They did it. But then they dismissed the challenge action. And yet, their brief and their argument is filled with the very issues that would be argued in such a challenge action. Those arguments are precluded by statute. If you go to the ruler, which is where I'd like to conclude my remarks, to date, the mall has received $12,600,000 in cash payments between the rent that it collected and the amount previously paid by the city of Green Bay, as against its original purchase price of a little over $6.3 million. And we're not done yet, because they hold the right to claim that they're entitled to more than the $12.6 million, because they are entitled to argue that they haven't been paid enough for the reversion, or they haven't been paid enough for the stream, or they haven't been paid enough for both of them. So here we are with you today in a case that is interesting to talk about, but it's a nowhere case. We have this remedy. It's available. When the jury speaks at the end of the condemnation case and says, this is the value, and that's the value, that's what they're entitled to. They've already received either the full benefit of their bargain, or they're short by the difference of the increased amount that the condemnation jury may award them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Margovitz. Mr. Southwick, representing the City of Green Bay and the City of Green Bay Redevelopment Authority.
May it please the Court. I'm Attorney Benjamin Southwick, and I'm here today representing the City of Green Bay and the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Green Bay. And I want to laud the petitioners, the mall, in their reply brief for having, in my mind, well delineated the issues here. Assuming for the sake of argument that Sachs breached the lease and that the mall was damaged by that breach, the issues appear to be, can a party maintain suit for breach of contract damages after all of that party's rights in the breached contract have been acquired by a condemnor? Or is the mall's breach of contract damages recoverable in this breach of contract action or in the mall's pending condemnation valuation action? The city takes the position that any damages that the mall might have, everything that the mall is entitled to, is recoverable in the eminent domain action. Bear in mind that the city acquired all of the mall's interests in the lease. One might ask the question in the colloquialism, what part of all don't you understand? The city acquired all of the mall's rights in the contract, and one cannot maintain suit on a contract in which one has no rights.
Or did it acquire all the responsibilities? I notice on page 17 of your brief, counsel, You say, therefore, the city recognizes its obligation to pay just compensation in the mall in accordance with the jury's verdict in the compensation case, which is the other one. Four, reversionary value. Okay, that seems clear under condemnation. The value of the lessor's interest in the lease. Okay, including the lessor's right to attorney fees and costs.
Yes, correct, Your
Honor. Accordance with the lease.
Correct.
And that if there's a viable claim for breach of contract, you're going to pay that too.
As I read and understand the condemnation law, Chief Justice, that I cited in the brief, the finder of fact, the city is obligated to pay every element of value of that which it obtained as determined by the jury on the date of evaluation of November 26, 2003.
Here's my problem. Suppose the court that tries the just compensation case doesn't agree with you on these. These are principles of law. And they come up short, and they only get A and B, and they don't get attorney fees, and they don't get breach of contract against you.
Well, I think the jury would be explained every element of that which we bought, including the terms of the contract, and the jury would put itself in the shoes of the willing and knowledgeable buyer in the marketplace of all of those things which the city acquired, and valuing it as of December 26, 2003, and the jury would determine compensation. The jury, as part of that analysis, could conclude that there was a breach and that the value to the mall of that breach under the contract was X. And that could be certainly one of the elements that the trier of fact could consider in the condemnation case.
Well, maybe this case should be held pending the condemnation award to make sure that they're adequately compensated for all of these items that you agree they should be compensated for.
I would respectfully submit the reverse, Chief Justice. I think doing that would run the very severe risk of a double recovery, and that's what we're concerned about. We want to pay just once here, and we want to pay in the context of the condemnation case. And the real worry here is that if this case continues, there could be damages in this case and then a double recovery, a windfall to the mall by recovering some or all of those damages again in the context of the condemnation case. And I think that's the real worry here, Chief.
I understand their issue. The real worry is that they're going to have a loss. And if they drop this lawsuit and they're out of a breach of contract and they don't get what they think is coming in condemnation proceedings because they disagree with you about the law in condemnation proceedings, that they're going to be out.
I totally disagree with the premise that somehow the law of eminent domain is going to short them. I think, in fact, the law of eminent domain is highly fair because of the case law, which I cited in the brief, which says that the trier of fact puts itself in the shoes, if you will, of the buyer in the marketplace, the willing and knowledgeable buyer, and it buying everything that the city acquired. And valuing it and considering every element that gave value to that which the city acquired as of the date of evaluation, and that is the jury's verdict. This is a total taking, so there will be one question on the verdict. So I think that risk is illusory that they're worried about the law of eminent domain. I think the law, being a law derived from the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, is a body of law that is, I would not be making a pun by saying eminently fair. I'm trying not to make a pun. And I think that's the case, Chief Justice. So I think that their assertion is a false assertion. It's their alleged damages are illusory, in my opinion.
Mr. Southwick, given the allegations of collusion, given the allegations of violations of the requirement of good faith, is there any potential here for the mall, either in this action or in the condemnation action, to recover punitive damages?
I don't think so, Justice. The problem I think that the mall has here is that they brought and dismissed the right to take case under Section 3205, and by that dismissal, they admitted that the acquisition by the city of all the rights that it acquired was for a public purpose, that it was by due process of law, that it was in accordance with the statutory title acquisition procedure in Section 3205. I agree with my colleague, Mr. Markovitz, that I read these briefs and I read all the trash talk about the collusion and all that kind of thing, but they admitted all of these things by dismissing the right to take case. The only issue here by, according to Section 3205 of the statutes, the only issue here is just compensation. How the condemnation came about and whether it was for a public purpose or for a purpose of aiding sex, they can't raise any of these issues anymore. They dismissed that right to take case in which they could have raised any issue other than just compensation. I think they're precluded, and I think they should have been really rightfully not been able to say that in the brief, but of course we...
Counselor, do you agree that in the course of a condemnation damages trial that you would be required to pay them for the stream of income of the lease discounted according to the contract rate in the contract?
But I think that in the worst-case scenario from the city's standpoint, if the jury concluded that there was a breach and if the court concluded that the liquidated damages clause in the contract was not a penalty clause, if all those things took place, the jury then would be able to award damages under the liquidated damages clause of the lease. I think that's an excellent question, Justice. But we do... And I said this in the brief. I'm concerned that the Court of Appeals opinion did not leave open the city's right in a motion in limine to assert that liquidated damages clause is a penalty clause. And I hope the opinion of this Court respectfully urged that language be clarified so that the city in the condemnation action will be able to assert a question of law to the trial court. That is to say that the liquidated damages clause in the lease is, in fact, an impermissible penalty clause. We want that right in the condemnation action. But otherwise, I think yes is the answer, Justice. So I've pretty much covered by the Court's very apt questioning the matters I was going to give in my talk. I think that the petitioner's damages are illusory here. They're really talking, as I read the briefs, they really seem to be concerned about two things. They seem to be concerned about the fact that they did not receive the rent payments in accordance with the timing in the future of the lease. And that seems to have upset the house of cards that they set up with this hell or high water clause. What they did receive and what is required by the condemnation laws is the value of that future rent stream as of the date of acquisition of November 26, 2003. In other words, that future rent stream has to be accordioned, if you will, down to a present value as of November 26, 2003. But as I pointed out in the brief, we see all the time, both in life and in the law, we see this transference between the value of a future income stream paid out in the future versus its present value. We see that in divorce law. We see that in pension law. We see that in lots of ways. And so there is no difference between the value paid in the future versus the value at the present time. The dispute can come over the discount rate. But there is no difference. In other words, of saying it is, there is a sum of money which, assuming a particular interest rate, could have been put in the bank and an annuity bought which would have precisely paid out on November 26, 2003, which would have precisely paid out the rent payments that were called for in the lease. So really all we're talking about here is value as of the date of acquisition of November 26, 2003, and that's precisely the question in the pending condemnation case.
What factor did the city use to determine present value?
We had a professional appraisal report. By statute, we did that, and we had a sophisticated appraiser from another state, a very sophisticated person, who we took very seriously our obligation to pay just compensation, and the lawyers were very aware, and the city was very aware of exactly what it was acquiring, and we explained that to the appraiser. We hired an, I say, sophisticated, expensive as well, appraiser who appraised the property as the statute requires, and we based our jurisdictional offer on that appraisal as the statute requires.
Was the discount rate on that?
My recollection fails me, but it was higher than 5%. There we go.
Which gave them less money, is that correct?
Yes, Chief Justice. The higher the discount rate, lower the present value. That's absolutely correct, the inverse relationship. And, of course, I'm assuming that'll be, those will all be fought out, those issues of what's an appropriate discount rate. That would be fought out in the condemnation valuation case, which is pending. And I'm sure they'll come up with a high-powered expert who says that you ought to use 3%, and we'll have a high-powered expert that says we ought to use 13%, and the jury will decide. But that still gets back to the core point I want to make, is that this case is about nothing.
Mr. Southwick.
Sounds like it's about money.
It's about money.
100%.
It's all about money. Nobody died here. Nobody died. It's all about money.
Mr. Southwick.
I'm sorry. Judge Prosser.
Should the court be concerned about the allegations of conversations between the city and Sachs, basically to help Sachs breach a contract?
Not in my opinion, because I think you've got preclusion here because of the dismissal of the right-to-take case. And the statute under which that right-to-take case was, in fact, brought, it says that every issue other than just compensation must be brought in a right-to-take case. They brought such a case. They voluntarily dismissed it. End of story. I don't think they can talk about, in a judicial forum, any of those issues anymore. The only issue left for them, in this attorney's opinion and the city's opinion, is the just compensation issue, and that's the subject of pending litigation. I just don't see, I would respectfully urge the court to conclude that especially in order to avoid the thing I'm concerned about, is double payment here. And I think the only way that can be avoided is for this case to be dismissed. And I respectfully urge this court on behalf.
Mr.
I know you're getting ready to wind up, but I guess I have a question.
Winding up here, Justice Young.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding something, but as I understood opposing counsel's position here, what they seem to be asserting in their briefs is that, yeah, we recognize that we have a condemnation action here, and that condemnation action is moving forward, and they're going to assess all the values that are there to be applied. But what I hear them saying is, but we contracted for something independent of the condemnation. This has nothing to do with the condemnation. We have a separate contract that deals with the sale-leaseback provision, and that separate contract ought to be honored. Now, I know that it seems like everybody's talking past each other, and that you're talking about the condemnation action, and this ends that. And what they're saying is that we've got something totally different going on here that we want you to recognize. And so I guess my question for you is there, under Wisconsin law, a way that the parties can contract separately from a condemnation action when condemnation?
I think that's an excellent question, Justice Butler, and I would invoke the Humpty Dumpty Doctrine.
The Humpty Dumpty Doctrine.
That is, all the best lawyers from all the best law firms in the world can try to deal with condemnation and try to be superior to it, but yet the condemnation comes along and takes that which it takes, which in this case was all of the lessor's interest in the contract, and Humpty Dumpty can't put himself back together again. In other words, I don't think that it's possible. I don't mean to be flippant, but I think that, in short, in all instances, the law of condemnation trumps, as the trial court so aptly said, the law of contracts here. And I don't think the best lawyers and the best law firms in the world can come up with a contract that prevents that. We had a taking here of all of the interests of the mall in this contract. And I think that is proper, and they conceded that it's proper. by dismissing the right to take case, and I think that their damages, whatever they think they may be, are compensable in the context of the right to take case. And I think the law is, I would respectfully submit, the law of eminent domain trumps the law of contracts. So that gets me, in all due respect, to the Humpty Dumpty Doctrine.
Mr. Southwick, you're here to, in effect, affirming the Court of Appeals decision, but you don't really like it.
Well, the thing I don't like about it...
So tell me, should you prevail, is it paragraph 13 and 14 that, and maybe 15, is that what's sticking in, raising a problem?
Well, I don't know if I could put my hand on that.
Well, it's in Wisconsin Mall's appendix at page 8, maybe elsewhere.
I thank my colleague, Mr. Conway, for handing it to me.
I don't like, Chief Justice, the inference that one could make from that paragraph, starting with the sentence, if the mall proves in an appeal, in the appeal of the award of compensation, et cetera. I don't like the inference that one might make that the trial court is required, if there's a breach of contract, to utilize Section 7.1 sub G of the lease. I want the city to have the ability to raise the legal issue before the trial court that that is an improper penalty clause, because I think it is.
You're conceding that the concept that you're bound by the contract is valid, but if the contract is invalid in any particular part, you're not bound by that. Is that your point?
My point is that we recognize our obligation to pay every right that we took in the contract, but we do want to assert the right to be able to assert that liquidated damages clause is a penalty clause.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Court.
Conway, representing Wisconsin Mall.
Esteemed counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the Court, may it please the Court, I want to put one issue to rest once and for all right now. You've heard both of these gentlemen cry about their concern about double counting. Maybe we'll end up paying more than we should. We've been accused of that throughout this case. If you look in the trial court record, which is before you, you will see that we said, all we're asking for is the difference between what we got and what we should have got. We're not asking you to get paid twice. And as a matter of fact, the Court of Appeals says the same thing, where they say, if your damages exceed 5.1, let's say we get damages of 8 or 9. Then you have to credit that 5.1 against the 8 or 9, you only get the balance. So
that's in the condemnation award,
of course.
As they say. Okay.
So that's
you
correct.
Want it to be
yeah.
in the
circuit court. You're right, Judge. And we spent about 5 or 6 minutes chasing that rabbit down the wrong rabbit hole. Then with regard to all of you, in one way or another today, have asked, what is the difference? What are you here for? You got your condemnation award. If you don't, I can appeal it. The difference is huge. We had a contractual right to recover that income stream discounted at 5%.
Counselor, what section of the contract is that in? I was
7.1, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Go
correct,
ahead. Sorry to interrupt you.
7.1G.
Thank you.
So we had a right to... what we said in this lease is, look, hell or high water, the only way we're going to lose here is if you go bankrupt. Every other contingency is covered for it, even condemnation. And it says right in the lease, even if there's condemnation, in fact, it says it right in the summary, that this part of the it says even if there's condemnation, you still have to pay us every dollar you owe through the end of this lease. At the time of the condemnation, the lease wouldn't expire until 2014. We had 9 years more of lease, of rent payments coming. When the city made their award, they hired an appraiser, and this is in the record at number 44 of Allison Swanson's deposition, affidavit? Yeah, of the city attorney Allison Swanson's here today of her affidavit. And that appraisal's here in the record, and I've given you the site. That appraisal says, this really isn't a lease. It is a lease in name only. What it is a financing vehicle.
And the discount rate ought to be 13%. Now, I would point out to you that if you read the Wall Street Journal today, you'll find that Sachs is getting 6% for its bonds. So how are we supposed to get 13% when even Sachs can't get more than 13%? Okay, what's the difference? The difference is approximately $3.8 million.
Okay.
If you use 5% instead of 13, we're short $3.8 million.
But my question, and I think the concern is that your hell or high water provision, what's the validity of that? In other words, if eminent domain, I mean, the law seems to, you can correct me on this, that the condemnation left nothing there. In other words, where's the law that gets around?
Well, let me address that, Judge. First of all, there's a ton of cases in our brief that say that's not so. They criticize those cases saying that has to do with equipment lease. You can't find a real estate case. Okay. Court of Appeals says we can't find one either. They say it right in the opinion. It's a novel case. You haven't cited. We can't find one that applies to real estate. Two answers for you. Number one, why should the rule for real estate be any different? This is what we bargained for, and they have found a clever, collusive way to get out of keeping the promise they made in that lease. Mr. Markowitz, the documents and discovery in this case show that Mr. Markowitz was hired to be the architect of this scheme to get Sachs out of downtown in the cheapest way possible. And why the old fox that he is, he did it.
And now, hence old.
We resent old.
I'm a lot closer to all of you than you might think. I'll amend it to Wiley Fox. So Wiley Fox that he is, he then creates this scheme. They go off and say to the city, we will pay you $4 million. That's how bad we're hurting downtown. We will give you $4 million to condemn us in spite of a clause that says we will not seek to avoid, rescind, or get out of this lease. And that's exactly what they did. They violated that clause. Because it was cheaper for them to get out of downtown and get out to Bay Park Square, which is a more popular place, as is the case in every city. And I want to warn the court, there are six other Sachs stores in Wisconsin right now owned by Wisconsin Mall Properties. And if they get away with it here, they're going to get away with it in Wausau and Sheboygan and Fond du Lac. And, in fact, Easttown and Westtown and Madison.
With the very same clause in it about eminent domain, I take it.
I'm sorry, Judge.
With the very same clause in it about eminent domain?
Okay. Yes. And with regard to the infirmity and the advantage we took of them when drafting this lease, they referred to that they got fooled. They got fooled with Sidley and Austin counseling them, who is also appears in this case now. And need I say more?
Yes.
They paid a lot, I know that. Whether they got fooled is another matter.
Why was the 3205 action the right right not to take or whatever that is. Why was that dismissed?
Oh, that was dismissed because we had to pay bondholders. And we had to take months to try that case. We were losing money at $1,300 a day and we were going to be declared in default. So we had to take the cash. Now, the suggestion has been made, and Justice Robinson, I think, asked this question and it was a good one. Well, wait a minute. What you dismissed is your claim against the city. Any rights you may have given up there, as Mr. Southwick so fervently argues, are gone. That may be true. I don't have to answer that question today because the city's not before you. What's before you is what our argument is. We started a claim against Sachs. And then Justice Wilcox said, but didn't all that disappear at the moment of condemnation? And aren't all the rights under the lease gone under condemnation? If they're gone, then how come the Court of Appeals is coming back and saying, no, they're not gone. You still have the right to 5%. You still have the right to this. You just go to condemnation court. Now, you may ask us, well, what's the matter with that? Why don't you quit whining and just go to condemnation court and get this over with? Let me tell you. A, there's going to be dueling economists on what the discount rate should be. That wouldn't be the case in contract court. 5% would prevail because that's what the contract says. B, we would have the right party in front of us, Sachs, so that the jury could hear that testimony. Sachs is not going to be a party in condemnation court. They can't be. C, we have to beat them by 15%. In circuit court, that wouldn't be the case. There is no such provision in contract law. D, punitive damages may not be available. Certainly, probably not available. Now, I have some others that I don't want to tick off, because if I say them and you put us in 32 court, they're going to come back and say, aha, you admitted before the Supreme Court that you couldn't get this, this, and this in 32, non-invoking judicial estoppel, and you should have shut up and stopped where you were before you gave the case away. But I can tell you there are four good reasons and several other ones why we are not going to get a fair shake in Chapter 32 court. Finally, I would ask you to consider this. When the Court of Appeals tells 32 court to handle this case in a certain way that's in conflict with decisions by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, what's the Chapter 32 court going to do? Is he going to say, I should follow District 3, or District 3 is ordering me to make a ruling that contradicts case law by this court? And last but not least, if our rights are all gone, we're now on a third form, and we would like very much to have an explanation as to what happened to our cause of action. We filed a cause of action for breach of the lease before the condemnation. Now, even if you buy their argument and say the lease vanishes into thin air and any rights you had under it are gone, what happened to our cause of action? That's a vested cause of action. It accrued when the wrongful conduct occurred. It vested when we filed. And everybody that's looked at this case has simply said, including the Court of Appeals, well, difficult metaphysical concept, but we think on a final basis, condemnation trumps all your other arguments.
Aren't they saying that you got a breach of contract action against the city in condemnation? They took over the contract with all of its rights and all of its responsibilities, all of everything, and go there and take care of it.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. No, they didn't say that, Judge, but you could argue that that's what they meant, and let me tell you why that's not right. That's not right because the city doesn't say, this is not a corporate merger or an asset purchase where the city says, once we take this over, we get all the benefit and all the liabilities like a private corporation would be where it buys another one. The city says, once we take this lease over, the only thing we have to do for you, Wisconsin Mall, is whatever is required in 32. And 32 doesn't say anything about us being exposed to the liabilities of our predecessor.
But both of you seem to at least agree on one thing, namely that the Court of Appeals in telling the condemnation court what to do may have overstated the law.
Indeed. Indeed.
That's your position. That's also the city's position, if I heard it.
For a different reason.
Yeah, for a different reason. I mean.
Now, I'd like to just revert for a moment. I know my time is up, and then I'll stop.
Right. This is it.
Yeah, you bet. Justice Romansack asked Mr. Southwick, well, what is going to be the rule in condemnation court? Are you conceding that you have to use that 5% that you contracted for? And what is the amount your appraiser actually used? And as you can see, he went on for about 7 minutes without stating the amount. And he claims, the faulty memory that goes with old age. So we had to prompt him a little bit and say, tell him it was 13%. And he did. Justice Roman said that question you asked was asked three times at the argument before the Court of Appeals by Judge King. Bang, bang, bang. To that same lawyer, he said to him, are you going to give him the 5%? Well, are you going to give him the 5% or not? Don't you agree there? Well, I'd have to confer with my client on it. Now, they know that they've got a much better situation in 32 court because they've got all kinds of technical reasons why what the Court of Appeals said should happen might not happen there because the rules are different. But I've given you substantive reasons, four of them, why we should be able to finish our cause of action against somebody who committed a breach against us before condemnation occurred.
Well, maybe this should be stalled until you see how you do in condemnation.
Well, Judge, we've already spent $700,000 on attorney's fees. Nobody wants to go to condemnation court, try that case. I'll come back up here and say, yeah, that was a mistake. Let's go back to circuit court. We want resolution of the matter.
What do you expect? state continue on with this case and continue on with condemnation too?
No, we can't do that. We acknowledge that. That would be double counting. All we want is to go back to where we were when the summary judgment came out. Let us try our collusion case.
And stay the condemnation award.
Correct.
So one has to be stayed.
Correct.
Whatever happens.
The condemnation case we now have on file at the trial court level in Brown County has to be stayed. This decision doesn't have to be stayed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank Ms. Stadler, Mr. Markovitz, Mr. Southwick, and Mr. Conway for their excellent arguments this morning on this case. We now conclude our hearing, 2005 AP 323, Wisconsin Wall Properties versus Yonkers et al. The court will be in recess until 1:30, and the students should remain, and Justice Brooks will be out shortly. We are in recess.